for the week of December 13th, 2015. This is Showbiz Sandbox 304, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, for the moment, I'm Michael Giltz.
And I would imagine you're saying for the moment because you're headed to family for the holidays.
That's right. So what's happening? Are we having a show next week?
I am around next week if you're
then, then we will have a show. You're the only one who ever keeps us from having a show. It's always you.
That's true, because even when you are on the road, and I mean that literally, not figuratively, you will actually pull over at a McDonald's or a Starbucks or someplace that has Wi-Fi, and we have a show.
So we don't have to reach out to people and tell them that we're not having a show next week, because we are. So if they want to reach out to us, however, what do they do?
Well, they can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. They can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can like us on Twitter, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, or, well, anywhere they give away podcasts for free, Stitcher, for instance. You can also like us on Facebook. I said like us on Twitter, but I meant follow us on Twitter. You can like us on Facebook, where if you search for Showbiz Sandbox, which is very difficult to say, search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up.
And isn't that what Lawrence Kaufman did?
That is what he did. He reached out to us on Facebook, and he is the chairman of the National Stereoscopic Association, and he clearly loves Well Done 3D and the history of that format.
Yeah, he was noting and he let us know how a number of movies that had been touted as being 3D ultimately weren't shown in 3D, at least in North America. The final Hunger Games movie was supposed to be in 3D, and for most of the world, it was. But here in the U.S., they dropped it. I don't think you could even pay a single ticket to see it in 3D. It was 2D only, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah. I didn't see it in 3D.
The upcoming Marvel film, Deadpool, also touted as 3D, and now quietly it looks like it's just going to be a 2D release in North America. Obviously, that's a business decision, right?
That is a business decision. It's also a decision about the release schedule and who has those 3D screens. Because even though just about every screen these days, especially if you have Real D, which requires a silver screen, so you need to prep for that up front, the equipment to show a 3D film may not necessarily be...
Hunger Games was not going begging for 3D screens. If they wanted to be shown in 3D, they could have been, and people would have happily accommodated them. Why was Hunger Games not shown in 3D?
I think that The Martian did better than expected in 3D, and those auditoriums were reserved for The Martian.
The Hunger Games is like twice as big as The Martian.
Yeah, I don't know what the...
Because people were not interested in seeing it in 3D. That's why. It was an afterthought artistically. It wasn't a thing. People are rejecting 3D in North America, and they turned away from it. Look, I didn't even realize that Star Wars was in 3D.
Yes.
I didn't even know that. In the Heart of the Sea, the new movie that opened this weekend and didn't do very well, also available in 3D, I had no idea. They barely are promoting it. Only one out of three people paid a 3D ticket to see In the Heart of the Sea, the Ron Howard movie. Two out of three people said, I don't want to pay in 3D. I want to see it in 2D.
Well, and in Star Wars, they actually shot some of the movie in 3D, although not all of it, and they did shoot some in IMAX. And by shoot in 3D, I mean they may have had two cameras going at some point that were ocularly separated for certain shots, but not...
But they designed it to be seen in 3D, and we'll have to find out after the reviews come out shortly as to what that means, whether it's good in 3D, whether it's okay, whether it doesn't matter. We'll find out because they're going to start showing it to... They have the premiere tonight, Monday, December 14th, and they're showing it to critics in New York on Tuesday, December 15th. And I'm sure that'll be happening all over the country and the world, I guess.
Yes,
so
at the same
time. The reviews will come out, and we'll talk about that in the show, about the opening night and all that. What else will we cover this week?
Well, on this week's show, we're going to be talking about the awards season because it is in full force. We'll mention the Golden Globes, but focus more on the first awards that matter, the SAG Awards. And why do they matter, Michael? They matter because, of course, some members of SAG actually vote on the Oscars, so it's our first hint on which movies they love. And here's a hint, the race is still wide open. We've also got more Star Wars news, because a day without Star Wars news is like a day without sunshine, at least according to Disney. During Inside Baseball, we'll talk with Sal Nunziato, a past guest on the show, the co-owner of the late lamented record store NYCD. Sal has just recorded a new album with his band. works record shows where he sells the newly popular vinyl LPs of old, blogs about music online, and is ready to weigh in on his favorite albums of 2015, as well as the favorite albums, the top albums of the year that Rolling Stone picked. Who better to get a state of the industry report on the music biz? Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the major entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We were talking about Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 2. In most of the world, it's in 3D. Here in North America, it's in 2D. But everywhere, it's a hit. $26 million over the weekend, $800 million worldwide and counting. So now you're looking at this movie making basically the same as Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 1. So clearly, the decision to split it up made sense commercially, at least in the short term. And number two around the world is The Good Dinosaur, a Pixar film, another $25 million. It's at $170 million worldwide, which is just about what it cost. It could be anywhere from $170 to $200 million. We don't really know, but that's roughly the cost of Pixar movies for the last few years.
And that's just production, remember, not marketing.
Well, that's what budget means.
Okay.
We all know they got to market the movies. And we all know that beyond box office, there's a whole bunch of money to be made on home video, do I still call it that, on DVD and Blu-ray and streaming and pay-per-view and on demand and, of course, syndication and, you know, local TV stations around the world. So there's a big aftermarket, especially for a family film like The Good Dinosaur. However, this looks like this might be the rare Pixar film that does not turn a profit at the box office. The last time it happened was Cars. That's practically the only time it happened for Pixar. And, of course, that movie made a ton in toys.
Were I was going to say,
Rescue Good Dinosaur? I don't know.
I was going to say, you know, Cars actually may be Pixar's, well, maybe Toy Story.
No,
but,
Toy Story.
Yeah, but Cars certainly, it's a billion-dollar franchise when you look at it.
Multi-billion dollar if you're talking toys.
Yeah.
And number three around the world is In the Heart of the Sea. This is the new Ron Howard film. It is not doing well.
No.
$23 million over the weekend, $50 million worldwide. About 40% of the sales were in 3D, according to Deadline, which means about 35% of the sales, ticket sales, were in 3D, because, of course, you make more money than you do sell tickets. So I'm confusing things, but I'd say one out of three tickets in North America were in 3D. They say the movie cost about $100 million. I'm now seeing other websites saying, gee, I don't know about that. That sounds awfully low. And they're hinting that it costs a lot more. We don't know. But we do know it got poor reviews and has not opened well.
Well, and I know that we're going to get emails and phone calls asking us why we think these movies are being released in 3D overseas. Now, In the Heart of the Sea was released in 3D in North America and overseas. And some of these movies are only being released overseas in international territories around the world in 3D, but not North America.
That's because the 3D fad. And all apologies to Lawrence Kaufman, 3D will be around forever. If it's done well, people will turn out. But it's a fad as far as the idea that almost every movie has to be 3D. And that fad peaked earlier in the U.S. than it has in the rest of the world.
That is correct.
Yeah, it'll slowly peak around the sea. You know, when you're doing Avatar or you're doing some movie where you take care with it and people are excited and you make clear, hey, this is an artistic choice. It's worth your time. It's worth your money. It's worth the pain in the neck of wearing the headsets. People will do it.
The headsets? You mean the glasses?
Yeah, but for most people, for most movies, it's not worth it. Little kids hate it. So unless the 3D is really going to wow them, they don't want to see The Good Dinosaur or some other movie in 3D.
Well, in The Heart of the Sea is just the latest, I don't want to say catastrophe, but the latest flop for Warner Brothers. And this is a movie that costs, as you said, $100, $140 million. It makes only $11 domestically. I think it's only up to $30 million internationally. And when you look at Warner Brothers this year, you've got Pan, Jupiter Ascending, Entourage, Hot Pursuit, Our Brand is Crisis, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. This is not a studio that is on a hot streak. It's remarkable to think this was the studio that had the Batman franchise, that had the Harry Potter franchise.
Well, it's not that hard to think, because that's what happens to every studio. They have ups and downs. And what does Warner Brothers have next? A Harry Potter spinoff franchise, right?
Right. But what I wanted to point out
Superman next summer, which people, my guys at the mailbox where I go, can't stop talking about Batman versus Superman.
Okay, well, what I was trying to point out is that those two franchises, Batman and Harry Potter, ended right at the time when Warner Brothers was choosing a new chairman. They had this bake-off, if you recall, Michael, where they had three executives all vying for the CEO position or the chairman position, and they chose Kevin Sugihara over the person from television and over, Oh my goodness, I'm totally forgetting his name now. But basically, it was the TV guy, the movie guy, and the home entertainment guy. Kevin Suzuhara, the home entertainment guy, won. Jeff Robinoff, the movie guy, he didn't win. It was going to be really between those two. And really, Jeff Robinoff left.
Yeah. We know all this. Yes, they got a new guy, and he's been handed the hard task of having to start from scratch with no big franchise to build on. And that's why you got to wait a few years and three or four or five years before you pass judgment on them. Anyone who says, "Oh, he's a disaster. Look how poorly it's doing." Well, guess what? All the big franchises came to an end, and he had to start from scratch.
Well, no. What I'm saying is that instead of picking one person to lead Warner Brothers Pictures, not the television, they chose three. And I don't know that this is actually working.
But except that these cycles are normal. They happen all the time to every studio in the world. Well, you're acting like this is some bizarre thing that they're having a down year. Universal, 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago, had a down year, right? I mean, down years are what happens to every studio. Warner Brothers will come back. And number four around the world is Surprise, Journey to the West, another take on the classic Monkey King legend that Chinese and Asians all around the world love. It's another comedy fantasy. It made $17 million in its opening weekend, and it's playing here in the U.S. I should check it out. And number five is the Bond film, Spectre, another $17 million. It's now at $820 million worldwide. And number six is Point Break. This is a remake of the Patrick Swayze, Keanu Reeves movie. It got a head start overseas, thank goodness, because the reviews aren't great. Another $12 million. It's at $35 million and counting for a movie that cost $120 million, which is probably more accurate than the budget of In the Heart of the Sea.
Now, can we just go back to Spectre for 1 second? I don't want to dote on it, but okay, it's made
You love doting.
I know. $820 million worldwide, right? Look at the number.
Biggest Bond film of all time.
Yeah, I'm not faulting it. Look at the number of territories it's in. 95 territories at once. That's pretty remarkable.
That's Bond, right?
Well, it's also the age of digital. So you're distributing in a digital age where you don't have to wait for prints to be done in one territory like North America or Australia to then use them in other territories.
So it's just a practical matter that it's so easy to be in so many territories at the same time.
Correct.
So that's one more reason why worldwide box office always took a little bit longer, because the expense, of course, there's still an expense connected to a digital print, right? For technical union reasons.
Well, now not union necessarily, but for technical reasons, yes, you actually have to technically and, you know, physically.
But no, aren't they? Don't they have a fee charge for prints, even though they're not creating prints anymore? And that's something that will hopefully fade away.
Yes. By 1999, between 2019 is the year I was trying to think of there.
Wow.
Through to about 2022, 23, there are VPFs, virtual print fees, being paid to movie theaters. These are the fees that allowed them to purchase the digital cinema equipment, which allows for digital distribution in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And those will fade out in the next 5 years.
Yes.
And then, well, 2023, actually, that's the next 8 years.
Well, but those are like huge outliers.
And then studios will say, but now we want you to buy this new toy.
Well, then it will become a consumer demand issue if you want Atmos or, you know, HDR, high dynamic range. And then
they won't need new machines when they want to switch over to a newer format. There's no format on the horizon they're going to need.
Well, not necessarily a newer format, but different bells and whistles they will need new machinery for. I think that that's going to be on exhibitors to, you know, cough up for their own.
So there's no new wholesale equipment they're going to need.
Well, projectors. They may, you know,
for Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, well, for Quentin Tarantino, you're going to actually.
No. I'm just saying. I mean, what do you mean projectors? Right. There's no new digital equipment on the horizon that they're going to have to replace the ones they bought 3 years ago.
Not for the next 5 to 10 years.
Okay. Yes. So in 8 years, when these fees end, then studios will be saying, "Now we want you to switch to this machine." That's my whole point. They said, "We want you to switch to the machine. We're going to have to help pay you because it's so expensive."
But you know what? There are standards in place so that the machines they're going to purchase will only be to upgrade to show something in high dynamic range or with some bell and whistle that a consumer actually wants.
So it won't be as dramatic as the last transfer.
Well, it will be dramatic as far as HDR is concerned because it is a much better picture, but it won't be as far as the equipment is concerned.
Well, I knew HDR was a big change for home. I didn't realize it was such a big change for movie theaters.
Oh, it most certainly is.
All right. And how far away is that?
It's being worked on now. You know, Inside Out was released in it. I would say you're probably a year or two from seeing regular releases.
All right. Well, back at the box office, Krampus, that's already a success, I would say. It's not there quite yet, but it cost $15 million to make. It made $11 million over the weekend. It's at $36 million worldwide. So when all is said and done, this is probably sure to be a profitable little horror flick. At number eight is Creed, still in the Oscar hunt, shockingly enough. That's the spinoff from the Rocky movies. Another $10 million over the weekend, $85 million and counting. Another Cinderella story for Rocky.
Yeah, hey.
And number nine is The Martian with Matt Damon. It made $10 million over the weekend, and it's almost at $600 million worldwide. Now, they say this movie cost $108 million, and I haven't raised an eyebrow. Why is that?
Probably because they were trying to make it on a budget. And really only contained a couple of locations. Well, no, that's not
true. On Mars,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's all blue screen and it's in a stage and it's easily contained. And there really were just a few sets, really, except for the shots in space.
Right.
So Martian really should be a lot cheaper than In the Heart of the Sea because you're shooting on water. And they did indeed shoot some on the water. And that's always super expensive. At number 10 is Bridge of Spies, the Steven Spielberg film. $7 million over the weekend, $122 million worldwide. The Peanuts movie, that's only made $16 million overseas. It's still chugging along. It's at $140 million worldwide, but most of that came in North America. I'm sure Fox knew, hey, how popular are Peanuts around the world? I'm sure they had that knowledge and information. It's only playing in 16 territories. It perhaps has a lot of territories to play in yet to come. It costs $100 million to make, and it needs to make money overseas in order for it to reach profitability. At number 12 is Inside Men, a South Korean thriller. Another $5 million over the weekend, $40 million and counting. Now there's a movie called The Master.
It's a movie about me. I see. Yeah. That's a movie about my, you know.
Yes, it's about you. And it's not the Philip Seymour Hoffman film, The Master. It is maybe a Netherlands comedy that came out in May. I don't think it's this Swedish comedy coming out in January called The Master Plan. There is a movie in one territory. I think it's probably playing in Asia called The Master. And I have no idea what it is. I looked and looked and couldn't figure it out, but it made $4 million over the weekend and it's at $5 million and counting. So the mystery is The Master. If you know what this movie is, give us a call and let us know. Showbiz Sandbox, right?
Yes, indeed. 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263.
So, you know, Star Wars is coming on Friday. Everybody's holding their breath. How much money will it make? It'll certainly set a record because I'm sure it'll make over $80 million on the weekend. But they had the craziest press conference or press junket in the history of movies, didn't they?
Yeah, because normally what happens is these press junkets, and I stopped going to them well over 10 years ago, but they kind of became a circus and everybody with a blog would show up. So they stopped doing roundtable interviews where it was the talent with like eight people around a table and started doing press conferences. But at least we had seen the movie. We would see the movie like, you know, on a Friday night, and then on a Saturday we would, you know, interview the talent, and that way we would have it for the next week or 2 weeks or whenever the movie came out. For Star Wars, and this kind of harkens back to when I say harkens back as if it was so long ago, but at Expo Cine they made us check our phones and no bags inside.
And they didn't
even
show you any footage.
And then they were like, and here's the trailer you've all seen before for Star Wars. And we thought, what? Why did you made us jump through all these hoops for that? But here they said, okay, no press is going to see the movie, but you're going to come and do the press conference. So you have to ask, these actors.
Right, they had a press conference for a movie that nobody had seen.
That's correct. Mindy Kaling was the moderator of said press conference. And
why Mindy Kaling?
I have no idea.
Is she a big fan of Star Wars?
Oh, she says she is. But
sure she is, but bizarre. Okay.
But the tweets and the mentions from the press about how they couldn't tell anybody where the press conference was being held.
Why would that matter?
Well, because they didn't want people sneaking in, I suppose. They didn't tell to the press where it was until 2 hours beforehand. And the
2 days.
2 days. Okay, well, my mistake. And they asked members of the press taking photos to turn off their geotagging when taking photos so that when they uploaded photos to Instagram and Facebook, that people wouldn't say, aha, it was held at the Four Seasons. In Beverly
Bizarre.
Hills.
So people are already lined up outside to see the movie. Some people use the lining up to raise money for charity. So that's nice to see. They turn something silly or exhausting into a good purpose. So that's nice. And they're closing down the streets in L.A. for tonight. It sounds like the whole city's shutting down. It's bigger than the Oscars, they say, as far as how much security and cops and setup they have for this movie. They're showing it like four theaters right next to each other, aren't they?
Well, yeah, but they're showing it basically where they're showing it at at what used to be called Grauman's Chinese Theater.
Right, right, right.
And it's in Hollywood. They shut down four blocks of Hollywood Boulevard. And I can, you know, just seeing the tent for it yesterday, I thought, wow, that is big. I'm not going anywhere near Hollywood. And I usually say that during the Oscars because they closed down half of Hollywood for that. They've done just as much for this premiere. It's absolutely out of control.
Right. It even connects to the biggest show on Broadway, Hamilton, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, talk about a great year for Lin-Manuel Miranda. I mean, here's a guy. He's got the, you know, hottest show on Broadway right now. It's getting rave reviews. It's a great show. He's on, you know, in every magazine and every newspaper and every, I mean, he's everywhere. And he made this joke to J.J. Abrams that, oh, yeah, I should write, if you need any cantina music, let me know. Guess what? J.J. Abrams took him up on it, and he wound up writing a song for a scene in the upcoming Star Wars. So not only does the guy have the hottest show on Broadway, he now has written music for the hottest movie of the year.
John Williams says, hey, back off, buddy.
Well, it was as he says, only the cantina music. And get this, not only didn't the press get to see the movie, okay, before they interviewed all the stars and the talent, but Lin-Manuel Miranda didn't get to see the scene he was writing the music for. He just did it blindly.
He's sure to be in the Tony hunt. That show is the front runner and will win the Tony for Best Musical next June. I don't care what show comes out, though I'm really looking forward to Shuffle Along and a couple others. Hamilton will win. But right now we've got people in the hunt for the Oscar, and we've got one of the biggest awards coming out so far is the SAG Awards, because like we said, they actually vote on the Oscars. Not everyone in SAG. It's much bigger than the Oscar group, but there are members of SAG who also vote on the Oscars. So this is our first hint at one of the guilds and what they're looking at.
That's right. I mean, the actor pool, the actor camp. God, I can't think of words today, but
No good you do.
I have no idea what you just said, I think. But they are the biggest contingency, the biggest voting block in the Academy, all the actors.
Right. So you want to pay attention to what the actors like, because that makes a big difference. And, you're looking about changing of the guard. Netflix, both at SAG and I think the Golden Globes, they have beaten out HBO. HBO has been sort of the front runner in the last few years, thanks to a lot of TV and movie. And now Netflix is beating them head to head. Netflix got the most nominations. Netflix. People were worried like a year ago, will people vote for a film from Amazon or Netflix? Of course they will. If it's good and they like it, they'll vote for it.
It will be very interesting to see how that translates to the Academy.
Yeah, well, it's been a wide open year for movies. Did SAG clarify anything at all? Did they say, all right, now these are the ones you really need to focus on? You know, did they sort of pick up the baton of one or two movies and champion them? What happened?
I would say maybe Spotlight, maybe The Big Short, not necessarily. No, they didn't do anything. They basically were all over the map when you start looking at
just
these nominations.
Just like everybody else, just like the LA Film Critics, the New York Film Critics, and the National Board of Review. Those all three split dramatically in virtually every category. Now we have SAG weighing in, and four out of five of their Best Picture nominees, that's their award for the best cast in a motion picture. That's their equivalent to Best Picture. Four out of the five are new to the conversation. Beasts of No Nation, The Big Short, Straight Outta Compton, and Trumbo. You know Trumbo's a player because it's about Hollywood, and so Hollywood actors love it. It's got a great cast. So the conversation just widens. It keeps getting wider because where you turn, there's more new movies being introduced. So when you talk about a wide open race and what 10 films, and it's going to be 9 or 10, I'll bet my shirt on that 9 or 10 movies are going to get nominated for Best Picture. The fact is, it's as wide open as can be. It's the widest open I can recall in my lifetime.
Well, and when you start to look at who the studios are behind some of these films, okay, Beasts of No Nation, Netflix, okay, they are kind of a first entry here, so they may not know how to run an Oscar campaign, although they can certainly afford it. Then you've got Spotlight, right, with Open Road Films. This is the distributor owned by Regal and AMC combined. Mm. So again, a little unusual
newcomers,
there.
Newcomers.
Newcomers. Yeah. And then Trumbo from Bleecker Street, a small outfit. Now, having indies and indie distributors in the Oscar hunt is not new, but these particular distributors are new to that scene.
They're very new, and learning how to run an Oscar campaign is important, and it's hard, and you get experience. That's why the Weinsteins are really good at it. So it's not something that's just automatic. You just turn on a switch and go, okay, we're going to run an Oscar campaign. Like, it's like running a presidential campaign, you know? You got to learn.
Yeah.
Sometimes you got to do it twice before you get good at it. So you can see them getting a nomination, but when you think about who's going to win, you got to take into account how good of a campaign are they running, because that matters.
Well, I wonder, this year, you're beginning to see, at least in the male and female actor leading role categories, some names being mentioned again and again.
No, no, you're not. SAG mentioned 4 out of the 5 of the new Best Actor nominees are brand new. The only person who's a repeat is...
DiCaprio?
No, Fassbender.
Okay.
Wasn't Fassbender the one who was repeated?
Well, maybe.
Yes. I think Bryan Cranston for Dumbo, Johnny Depp for Black Mass, Leonardo DiCaprio for The Revenant, and Eddie Redmayne for The Danish Girl are all new, I believe. Certainly, at most, Fassbender and DiCaprio have been in the conversation before. As far as nominations from L.A., New York, and the National Board of Review, now we got 4 new names thrown into the
mix. Okay, I see what you... I was like, new from where? But you just clarified that.
That's
okay.
What we're talking about. We're done. We've talked about the 3 biggest previous nominations, and now we've got a new one. Women, there's more overlap. Cate Blanchett, Brie Larson, Saoirse Ronan, those are all people that have been mentioned before. Helen Mirren and Sarah Silverman are perhaps new to the conversation. Helen Mirren for Woman in Gold as Best Actress and Best Supporting Actress for Trumbo, and Sarah Silverman for I Smile Back.
And what about, supporting roles? Are there new names there? I mean, it does seem like Christian Bale's name cropped up this time.
Yeah, there's definitely some more repetition here. Michael Shannon is still getting a lot of attention. Mark Rylance, Idris Elba. And they're being joined by the kid from Room, Jacob Tremblay, and Christian Bale for The Big Short. And same thing with the women. We've got a more repetition here. Rooney Mara for Carol. They have her in Best Supporting. She may also be considered by some as Best Lead. Rachel McAdams snuck in for Spotlight. Helen Mirren again, like I said. Kate Winslet for Steve Jobs. That's a new one. And Alicia Vikander, is that how you say her name?
Vikander.
Vikander, thank you. She's up for 2 different movies. Maybe The Danish Girl, maybe what's her other movie?
Ex Machina.
Ex Machina. So
how come I can remember that, but I can't remember like easy words?
All right. So again, these races are as wide open as I can recall, but SAG is the first one to sort of clarify things because they're an actual guild and they haven't clarified anything. They're like, yeah, I don't know. A lot of different movies that they like a lot. There's no front runner yet. Maybe Spotlight. But I don't think even that's a lock. I mean, I think it'll get a nomination. But as far as who's going to win the Oscar, I don't think anyone has a clue.
And certainly the Golden Globes have always been kind of pegged as a predictor of the Oscars. But in a way, they're not, because only about 95 people from around the world, they're like journalists, foreign journalists living in Hollywood, covering Hollywood, and they pick the Golden Globe nominees and winners.
Well, and they always had a secret cheat, which was that they named 10 films rather than 5. And it used to be there were only 5 Oscar nominees. So if you're going to name 10 movies, chances are you're going to cover 5 of the, 4 or 5. So predicting which 4 or 5 would get nominated for the Oscar when you get 10 picks, we could do that.
Yeah, well, because they do both motion picture drama and motion picture comedy or musical.
That's right. So a couple of their movies are unlikely to cross over. Spy and Trainwreck. Certainly not going to cross over.
And they were nominated in the Best Motion Picture Comedy category along with Joy and The Big Short. And, of course, that raunchy comedy, The Martian.
That's right. Well, they wanted to fit it in somewhere. If you look at all the Golden Globe nominations, I think the only lesson to be learned is that they're very good at casting a TV show.
That is you said it perfectly, because really there are times, I mean, wasn't a couple of years ago, what was it, the Interpreter or The Tourist, I can't even remember, it was some Johnny Depp movie that it was nominated for Best Picture comedy because they wanted Johnny Depp to show up.
Well, sure, who wouldn't? You got him, which just goes to tell you he's completely out of the Oscar race, because even the Golden Globes did not pick up the Johnny Depp banner for Black Mass. They have Bryan Cranston, Leonardo DiCaprio, Michael Fassbender, Eddie Redmayne, Will Smith. Those were their picks for the show. So you look at their picks, they're all a lot. There's some people you don't necessarily expect. Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin made an appearance, blah, 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 Melissa McCarthy. Basically, they're casting a TV show and they want as big name stars as they can for as the big popular movies. So they've got The Martian, they've got Mad Max, and they've got the big stars. I think if there's any perhaps a hint towards Oscars, we still see Mad Max getting traction. That has Best Picture, that has Best Director, which is perhaps their better indication of what movies they think are the front runners. Their pick for Best Directors are only 5, and they are Todd Haynes for Carol, Iñárritu for The Revenant, which I'm seeing tonight, Tom McCarthy for Spotlight, George Miller for Mad Max, and Ridley Scott for The Martian. So Miller and Scott are 2 veterans. They've got popular movies. A lot of critical acclaim, strong box office for The Martian, not as strong, but respectable for Mad Max, so that could even use the boost. So if you're looking at what movies are going to cross over to Oscar, those are the ones I think that we could say that the Golden Globes are giving their stamp of approval to. And I wouldn't be surprised if all of them were on the long list.
Yeah, I was a little surprised that Michael Caine didn't get nominated, unless he did. I don't see him anywhere. But Michael Caine
for what?
For Youth.
Oh, well, you know, it's a boring movie. So, I mean, you know, it's not a, Michael Caine's a marvelous actor, but, you know, it was a strong year for lead actors. But again, they're casting a TV show and maybe they wanted to have younger demos.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, Jane Fonda's got a hit, you know, online comedy. So maybe she got a Best Supporting Actress for Youth. So they clearly saw the movie. And they do have The Hateful Eight in the mix. Jennifer Jason Leigh got a Best Supporting Actress nomination. And we should point out, I think it's the only movie that I know of that was sort of shut out. I don't know whether they got screeners of joy to the SAG members, but I know that The Hateful Eight did not go out. So the SAG members did not have The Hateful Eight to watch and vote upon. So the fact that that's not in the list on SAG does not mean it won't pop up come Oscar time, especially since Tarantino is known to be a very actor-friendly director who creates roles and performances that give people a chance to shine, and Oscar loves to reward them. So we'll have to see what happens. But, you know, the fact that it ain't in SAG doesn't mean that The Hateful Eight won't be a player come Oscar time.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard from a number of industry folks this year who actually do go through the nomination process, both for SAG and, in some cases, the Academy. And they were frustrated that all of these movies, not necessarily Star Wars, because they know, you know, they don't think that they're going to be nominating that for, you know, Best Actor necessarily. But a lot of these movies, like Concussion, although they finally did start showing it, Hateful Eight being one of them, Joy being another, they're not showing these films until late. And of course, all of the nominations are due and the selections are due much earlier.
Well, I think the studio would always be wise to keep in mind and to worry less about the award shows and worry more about the movie. If you need more time, then for God's sakes, don't rush it out. And, you know, like, you know, if you want it in December, at the end of December, and you can't get it ready for awards, so what?
Yeah, you know, I actually spoke to one studio executive who said that the thinking for some is not necessarily that the movie isn't done, because in large part they are, is that they don't want to.
Well, Joy wasn't.
Well, okay, yes. They don't want to peak too early, some of these films. They don't want the awards buzz to, you know, start up at the beginning of December and completely die off by January.
You're talking about 4 weeks. We don't want to get lots of awards in early December, because we might not get nothing in January. But if you're not getting nominated by SAG and the Golden Globes and the DGA and the PGA, then you're not going to get nominated by the Oscar. I mean, that's just silly.
Well, the Oscars don't have television.
If you're going to be part of the awards season, then you need to have your movie ready to be seen. But worrying about award season rather than worrying about the movie and what's best for the movie and when you should release it and how it should be released and not showing it too soon because it's not quite ready yet is more important in the long term.
I think studio executives would say that it is best for the movie to worry about award season.
Okay, really?
I'm kidding. All right. But, you know, the Golden Globes also have TV.
So does SAG.
Yes, that's true. Now, do we care about that, or do we want to mention it?
No, you know, it's so out of tune with the Emmys that we almost don't care about it. I would say notably, like, SAG has no network shows for Best Drama. It's PBS, HBO, Showtime, Netflix, AMC, all the shows you would expect. The networks are only players in comedy, and, you know, and the same thing you see in the Golden Globes. The one thing I love that SAG does that I wish Oscar did was an award for Best Stunt Ensemble. Basically, they're doing award for Best Action Scenes. They do it in TV and they do it in movies. And, you know, it's a craft and it's an incredibly difficult and dangerous part of the business. And it's so central to movies like Mad Max and Star Wars and all these movies. You know, those stunts are a huge part of the movies. And it's great that they're giving it some recognition.
I was happy to see at the Golden Globes, you know, Gael Garcia Bernal and Mozart in the Jungle among the mix.
Is that a show you're watching?
It's a show that I did watch. Yeah, it was on Amazon.
Uh-huh. How many episodes was it?
I think maybe 10.
And will there be another season? Are you looking forward to it?
Not only will there be another season, but it was filmed at the Hollywood Bowl with the entire LA Philharmonic and an entire audience. There was a scene that was shot there. And he, like, you know, Bernal came up and he had to take over for Gustavo Dudamel, the conductor for the LA Phil. And he did it, like, live in front of the entire audience could get the shots.
So up next is the Directors Guild, the Producers Guild. Who's up next on board? Do we know?
I have absolutely No idea.
Because really, all we care about is the Oscar nominations.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Although, you know, the others are good too. But, you know, let's face it, everybody's looking at the Oscars.
Because the Oscars is the big deal.
Oh, what? Wait, well, if the Oscars are the big deal, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story today, well, it's actually in the last 5 years. Okay, Michael, it's no shock. Streaming has doubled its share of broadband usage in North America. It's gone from 35% of peak usage to 70% of peak usage. That means at peak hours, like prime time, some 70% of downloading involves streaming of video and audio. Of course, 60% of that is, Adele's new album. Just kidding. The culprits? YouTube, Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, Apple TV, and other services. Hence, the increasing usage of caps. These are data caps, slowdowns, and throttling, and the end of quote-unquote unlimited usage by internet providers. Hey, if you're not going to buy their cable bundle, they have to have some way of maintaining massive profits. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop, right? It's just the natural order of things. Nobody's surprised by this. You did talk about once upon a time how the way they measure this and account for this and how they were blaming Netflix was a little skewed. Is there anything skewed in this statistic, thinking that downloading, of course, which is what people don't usually do, usually they're uploading, if anything, right? I mean, downloading stuff at peak hours, this usage, this makes perfect sense to you, right?
Well, right. And here's the thing, you know, emails, which is what we all do from 9 to 5 every day, right? Is mostly what you're getting in the middle of the day. You're getting mostly data. I know that sounds odd.
And they're tiny and maybe they have a little attachment, but that's about it.
Yeah, it's lighter data. Whereas video and audio is a little bit heavier data. Well, at home, you'll answer the odd email. You might go through your emails at home. But really, when everybody goes home from, let's say, 5 p.m. to midnight, and they're saying, well, peak usage at that time, it's all, you know, these YouTubes and Netflixes. And well, yeah, no kidding, because, you know, all of a sudden you're shutting down most of the corporate world. And I think that's true all over the world, not just here in North America.
All right.
But now let's move on to NBC, because they have turned live TV musicals into an annual holiday tradition. Most recently, of course, Michael, with The Wiz. Fox hopes to follow suit with Grease and Rocky Horror. But not so fast. ABC wants in on the action. They won't be doing a live special, but they will be turning Dirty Dancing into a TV movie musical event. I don't even know. There's so many M's there. Movie, musical. Anyway, why are they doing this? Well, why not? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right? Do it well, and then we'll talk about it. But, you know, they're doing a TV movie musical, but it's another big property, another thing adding to the sense of event that TV wants and needs in order to bring in an audience and get you away from your damn Netflix.
You know what Hollywood is saying, Michael?
No.
It's alive! It's alive! And they're talking about DreamWorks, actually, because they are rising from, well, from the development dead, and they're finding a new home at Universal. I thought this story was mentioned weeks ago, frankly. I mean, everybody knows that's where they
were. But now they've got the actual funding, right?
Well, they had the funding of, in part from a number of sources several weeks ago. It was mentioned last month in the trades. But now the official word has come down that they will be moving from Disney. They got out of their Disney contract and officially moved to Universal. The Steven Spielberg shingle, or should we say mini studio or perhaps boutique label? I don't know. It's getting $200 million in a new deal that will see it move from Disney to, as I just mentioned, Spielberg's once and future home, Universal. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop too, but $200 million, is that like for offices and stuff? Because if that's for making movies, that really seems like a big whoop. I mean, $200 million is like one movie. I mean, I know he says he made Bridge of Spies for 40, but basically, if you're talking a big, maybe, you know, the BFG or something, which is a Disney movie, but Spielberg is directing, that's $100 million plus. So what's $200 million? Is that just like pocket change for keeping the lights on? It can't be the budget for movies.
No. Well, I think a part of it is overhead, as you just mentioned. But Participant Media came along as well, and I think they put in $300 million. I could be wrong about the amount there, but Participant Media gave them some money too. Mm-hmm. So I think if it's from Universal, then it's just, you know, $200 million from Universal and additional funds coming from other sources like output deals and Participant Media and Reliance, although I don't think Reliance.
But like you say, expected outcome, Spielberg back at Universal.
Correct. And I could have sworn it's kind of like, oh, this wasn't, okay. I thought it was done already. Kind of like, who will win the Tony Award next year? It'll be Hamilton, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this year, the musical Fun Home won the Tony Award. And this is a show about a lesbian cartoonist whose closeted gay father killed himself. It won rave reviews and a transfer to Broadway. And as we just mentioned, the Tony for Best Musical. But it's also accomplished the most difficult reward of all, making money. Yes, thanks to a low weekly running cost and a show driven more by reviews than by stars, Fun Home has recouped its $5.25 million budget. It's hard to believe they put that much money into that show, but the show...
That's not a lot of money at all. Typical Broadway musical is like $15
million. Well, yes, but I just can't believe they put that much money into that show. The show peaked in weekly grosses in the heady weeks after the Tonys, but even now, when it's only making some $500,000 per week during the busiest time of the year on Broadway, producers say it's making money every single week. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I was not a big supporter of the show, though philosophically, I'm delighted to see it do well, but I gave it more mixed reviews than almost anybody else. But it's great. They really took a gamble and it paid off. They got a national tour booked. They're doing a show overseas. The first one is going to be in the Philippines with Lea Salonga, who's currently on Broadway in Allegiance. She'll be the lead. They're still looking at the West End production, which I don't think is a good idea commercially. I think they got lucky. But, they're 8 months into the run, and it's going to be a tough winter. Right now, this show and any show should be making the most money it will all year long. And so to be dropping in the grosses during the Thanksgiving to Christmas week means come winter, you're really going to drop further.
Yeah,
I don't know what the weekly nut is for this show. It's clearly very low because they have a small pit and a small cast and it's a small space. So clearly if they're making money on $500,000 per week, their nut is very, very small, but it can't be that much smaller. So come January, February, I don't think this show is going to see beyond a year, but you never know. It's proven me wrong every step of the way.
Well, certainly a show that we'll see beyond a year is Hamilton. I know we mentioned it at the top of this story.
Maybe beyond 10 years, which is crazy to say, but that's what we're looking at.
Yeah, well, now it's getting life in Chicago. And I like this phrase. It's getting a sit-down production in Chicago, meaning that it's not a touring musical. It's going to actually, take residence at a theater and play a long run.
Right. It's open-ended. So instead of touring and being in town for like 2 or 3 days or even 2 or 3 weeks or something that some shows will do, this is an open-ended run in Chicago. So they think it's far enough away from New York. It's a great theater town with a lot of strong theater going, plus a great supply of actors to pull from. And it can reach a lot of people in that region who don't want to make it to all the way to New York. So this is where they're going to have an open-ended run. They've done it in Vegas. They've done it in other cities. They're doing it in Chicago for Hamilton. I'm sure it will be a massive success.
Well, even if they could make it all the way to New York to see Hamilton, they couldn't get tickets, trust me.
True, exactly.
Melissa McCarthy is one of the most in-demand stars in Hollywood these days, with a string of successful comedies to her name. But that's not enough to keep her sitcom on the air. Mike and Molly has been canceled by CBS. No surprise after the network trimmed the number of episodes in the sixth season from 22 down to 13.
It's not official yet, but that's certainly one of the cast members said, oh, it's over.
Well, the show is never a blockbuster. It's been a steady performer, though, modestly declining from about 11 million viewers a week in season one down to 10 million viewers. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop. It just reflects how strong a schedule CBS has that they can cancel the show. I mean, I think what happened is her contract is up for renewal. After season six, they got to pay her more money.
That's right.
They have to pay her a ton of more money. And maybe she's not interested. They've done it for 6 years. She's got Ghostbusters. She's got movie hits every year. They've got enough episodes for syndication. I don't think it's worth her time or their money. And I think they said, hey, we've had a good 6-year run. Let's walk away. Because otherwise, this show should still be running.
You know what we should put on in its place? Hey, have we done NCIS in Baton Rouge?
Oh, I thought you were going to say Showbiz Sandbox, the TV show.
Oh, yeah, well, yes, actually. Yes, they should. But, NCIS Des Moines is probably more.
We're not going to make New York one.
No, exactly. Oh, goodness. Well, Jared Leto, the actor and the musician, he's an Academy Award winning actor, by the way, now, Michael. He had a videographer in his home recording him while he critiqued the new album by Taylor Swift, 1989, because, who doesn't do that? Anyway, the comments were mostly friendly, but towards the end, Leto made a dismissive, expletive remark about the pop star. Sensing money to be made, the videographer took the footage to TMZ. They paid him $2,000, but wanted the guy to sign a statement saying he had the legal right to sell them the footage. He refused, but kept the money. They ran the footage anyway, and now Leto is suing. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop until he sues successfully and they pay and they stop doing this. I mean, it's just, there's such a preying on celebrities. I mean, you know, people can choose to be in the public eye and they make money off being famous. Other people choose, they want their privacy. But, you know, when you're paying off people you know are lying and giving you footage they don't have the right to and say, well, but sign this and, you know, they're all this big pretend. It's like, you know, people should have some privacy just because they're a movie star. You know, they should have some right to their own private life. You know, it's exhausting. But what is the difference here between this as fair use and, say, the massive leaks of studio documents that we were like, of course people should report on it. It's out there. You know, what is the difference there?
Well, I mean, I think in the leak case, there's a crime being committed, right?
They're paying someone to give them the footage as opposed to it's already out in the public domain and it's of journalistic interest as opposed to Jared Leto making an offhanded comment about Taylor Swift is not really of journalistic interest. It's just a cheap, sleazy thing.
Yeah, and quite honestly, what it's going to do, now I don't know why in the world he had, you know, a videographer in his home to talk about Taylor Swift's album, but it's just going to mean that, you know, it's going to be harder and harder to access talent like that.
Well, it was his own videographer. It was him doing it. It wasn't, I don't think it was some outside person that Jared Leto agreed to let come in. I think he had hired the guy to shoot stuff. And then this scrap of video, the guy thought, oh, that's good, and tried to sell it. And then he felt bad and told Jared Leto what he did and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, it's not that like E! Entertainment News was there filming him. Just he hired someone to do it because why not?
Why is this even a story then?
Well, because it's TMZ buying illegal footage, and it's just that whole culture of paying paparazzi for photos and, you know, acting blandly indifferent when you realize that they're stalking people, making their lives miserable and yelling at them, trying to get them, provoke them into doing something that they can take a photo of. You know, when you pay them and you support them and you do that, you're supporting that whole culture. If you didn't pay for it and you didn't use the photos ever, these people would not be around doing this crap.
Well, and it's not just celebrities that have to worry about paparazzi. Around the corner from my daughter's school, there are paparazzi lined up waiting for celebrities to come out of what is a neighborhood, a gated neighborhood here known as the Oaks. And they sit there and they wait and they wait and they're parked there forever. It's a big pain in the neck.
Well, right. What do you mean? That's exactly what we're talking about.
Oh, okay. Well, all right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, first Apple wanted to create a connected TV that would be better than other TVs. They settled for the streaming device Apple TV. Then they wanted to replace your cable provider with its own bundle of networks. Now it looks like they're settling for encouraging folk to reach Apple consumers via the App Store. Bloomberg News reports Apple's plans for bundling are on hold after negotiations failed to reach a decent price point. And CBS's Les Moonves, who is actually leaking more Apple news than anybody these days, he told investors the same thing in a conference call. Meanwhile, Apple and Amazon are both offering more and more channels via their stores. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal because they wanted to bundle and somebody wants to break through and create an actual alternative to cable that's cheaper and but has a broad range of actual major networks and top cable channels. And they couldn't do it. Apple couldn't do it. They couldn't come to a deal. You know, people talk about, oh, people are unbundled. They're paying for TV one way or the other. And, you know, breaking the back of cable just means they're going to be paying for it online. But it's really hard to replace that. They're talking about like 20% of all homes will get rid of cable in the next 5 years. That in North America, I'm like, really? I don't think so.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily doubt it.
Why not? You think one out of five people who have cable are going to get rid of it in the next 5 years?
If they can get the same programming.
They can't.
Well,
that's the whole point. No option for it right now. You can't get sports. You can't get most channels. You can't get the major networks. You can't get, you know, it's harder and harder to replace that. And if they're just replacing one bill with another, then it's not what they've been talking about for decades.
Well, if they can get the programming they want, then it could happen. And that's right. What Les Moonves is saying. And what he's saying, and quite honestly, he is the head of CBS, and what he is saying is, look, skinny bundles, as he's calling them, thinner bundles, are coming.
Yes.
Okay? So get ready for that. We were in talks with Apple. We were willing to talk to them. Some of the other networks and other companies weren't. So at some point they will be. This is going to happen. It's going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years. So get ready for it. And that's really what he's saying. And he pegs the price somewhere around $30 a month.
But if CBS, if Apple couldn't make it happen yet, it's who the heck is going to make it work?
Well, you know, part of the issue, and it was the same thing with virtual print fees and in the motion picture industry, is you get one network like a CBS saying, okay, we're willing to talk. Let's talk. And then you don't get NBC or you don't get ABC. So then everything falls apart. You know, you basically need a core group of networks. And it's just, you know,
all known as ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, and I guess the CW, though you don't really need the CW.
Well, no, I mean, you also need like maybe the MTV, the CNN, you know, you basically need certain cable channels and networks to get on board. Otherwise, you don't
and
have
ABC
anything.
Is still wary of making ESPN available on its own.
Yeah, understandably.
Even though they lost 7 million subscribers over the, you know, almost 10% of their subscribers in the last 2 years.
Yeah, it's understandable. Yeah.
No, I mean, shouldn't they be less wary and more worried and saying we need to be proactive and get out front?
Well, there will be a tipping point.
Well, there's certainly been a tipping point in the music business because music sales have collapsed. We mentioned Adele's album. It is the best-selling album of the year. Until it came out, Taylor Swift's 1989 album, which came out the year before in 2014, was the best-selling album of this year as well because it had sold 1.89 million copies, 1,800,000 copies of her album, 1989. That made it the biggest album of the year until Adele came along. That is how low album sales are. The music sale industry has collapsed. Right? All the money is in streaming. There's just so many changes in music. I wish there was someone we could talk to about all the changes going on in the music industry. Someone who could bring a perspective of like an artist and an independent store owner and a blogger and a reviewer. If only there was someone we could talk to like that.
Well, actually, Michael, there is somebody that we can talk to. His name is Sal Nunziato, and he's going to be joining us for Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And as I just mentioned, we're going to be talking to Sal Nunziato. His band has just been in the recording studio. He's the co-owner of the late lamented record store NYCD, and he works record shows and you know, online platforms like Amazon and eBay to sell vinyl LPs and music. Sal, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You also have an online blog called Burnwood Tonight. And I realize like you encapsulate the entire music business in one person. You are all of music wrapped up in one.
That's right.
It's amazing. It's amazing. So your band was just in the studio. I want to start with that. What's the name of the band? What did you record? How did you record? Was it a professional studio? Someone's home setup, which is just as good as a professional. You know, what did it cost? Did you have a Kickstarter campaign? Tell us about it.
Okay, it's a friend of mine who's a singer-songwriter, John Dunbar, who's been making records for the better part of 20 years. He was asked to do a live gig for the International Pop Overthrow, which is this worldwide festival of power pop artists. And he needed a band because he usually performs by himself, and they wanted him to perform at this festival, but he needed to get a band together. And he asked me to play drums, and he asked the great bass player Sal Mehta, who's been with Roxy Music and Cracker and Ronnie Spector and Mary Weiss of the Shangri-Las. And we rehearsed a bunch of John Dunbar originals, did the gig, went over really well, and decided to take it a step further. So we are now in the process of recording an album's length set of songs, and so far it's been a great experience just playing. I've been a fan and a friend of Sal Mehta for a very long time, and John Dunbar's songs are fantastic, very Ray Davies, Elvis Costello influenced, and that's where we are right now. We're laying down basic tracks. We're going to finish some more, and hopefully have something out early next year.
Very cool. So is this something he's self-financing? Are you recording at his home studio? Where's it happening? Because these days you can record anywhere.
Right. No, this is happening at a recording studio that he is financing. And I'm not sure much more than that. I mean, I know where the studio is and I know what we're doing. But in terms of cost, this is totally, this is his thing. And we're going to see where it goes. It's something that's really gelling as it goes along. It's one of those things, you know, I've played in bands for God knows how long, and it's not always great. It's all those stories that you hear, who doesn't get along and whose ego gets in the way. And so far, this has just been wonderful, where we're working off of each other, and I couldn't be happier with it. So I'm excited about hearing a final product.
Now, Sal, I noticed that you skipped over the sex and drugs part of being in a band.
For no other reason than you hadn't asked. but
that's the best part of being in a band.
You know, and now it's, we're older, so it's more like soup and naps.
you've gone the whole journey. You've gone from a fan who would go to record shows and buy LPs to, I mean, I don't know whether music was your dream always, or whether like going in a record store was like the ultimate. You get to have a business. You talked about music all day long. You got to play music, turn people on to music you love. And that led to you, like you and your co-owner, Tony Sachs, you both wrote liner notes for albums and reissues for artists that you loved, which is pretty damn cool. And then you got artists that you loved to come to the record store and play. So you became like a booker. You'd get the Posies and other people that you were crazy about to come to your store and play some music. And you had your own bands, of course, over the years. And then it all segued into online retailing and now online blogging. And now you're back again at record shows selling LPs, the same damn format you were 40 years ago. Right. But now you're selling them rather than buying them.
That's right. I am still buying them. I'm one of the worst record dealers out there, because I'll buy an incredible collection of records that are just raring to be sold, and most of them just end up on my shelf. So it's, you know, I love music that much. And I guess the dream originally was to be a DJ. I wanted to be on WNEW FM, right there in between Scott Muni and Allison Steele. That is something that I wanted to do, and I still have that dream. You know, I still wish I can play music and talk about music for people to hear on a daily basis. But you know, the blog, in some ways, it's not a great substitute, but it does some of that. So that's the dream. And then, you know, having the record store, I mean, I miss it now. You know, I didn't miss it then when things weren't going well, but I certainly miss it now.
Yeah. And so we've got a year of music, and you're online blogging about it, which is what people do now. And you've got fans, people who follow you. They've been customers, and they're online, and they get in conversations about the great music that they love. It's a good community you have at Burn Wood Tonight. How do you spell that?
It's actually, the blog is called Burning Wood.
Yeah, but the website is Burnwood.
Right, it's Burnwood Tonight with an I-T-E, .blogspot.com.
So you've got a best of the year list, your favorite albums of the year that you've done, like towards the end of the year, like people will. Is that a quaint relic of the past? Do people even think in terms of albums anymore? I don't know if that even has currency as much. And we see some people on your website who comment and say, yeah, you know, I don't think about albums anymore.
Yeah, that upsets me when I see those comments, and you know, you get to know these people. Some I know very well. Some are customers of mine from the past. Some are friends of friends. But there are others who I've never met, but I feel like I know them really well because of how often they comment and the conversations that we've had. And one person, he always talks about how he gives each song 30 seconds, and if it doesn't grab him in the first 30 seconds, he moves on, and that upsets me. That to me is not a way to listen to music. There are people who say they find, you know, two or three songs off of a record, create a folder on their computers, and they forget about the album completely. And that's fine. I mean, we all do that. We all find a couple of songs off of something and you know, focus on those as opposed to the others. But I do believe that the right way is from beginning to end. And, you know, back then, whenever then is, but it wasn't an issue. You know, it wasn't an issue to listen to a handful of records from beginning to end.
Well, I mean, it was also the format when you think about it. I mean, the format was you put a whole bunch of songs on one side of a vinyl disc, and then you turn it over and you put a whole bunch of other songs on it. And that's the way you distributed. Right.
Yeah, but except back then, you had access to two or three or four a week, or sometimes two, three, four a month. Now it's 25,000
Right.
It's just, and I don't think that that's a good thing. I really don't. I've had this discussion with many people. I've written about it. I had a Times op-ed piece about it where.
And by Times, we should say this is the New York Times.
That's right.
Right. Yeah.
The New York Times. And you know, I had a number of people, a number of comments were very positive and supportive of what I was saying, but so many just thought it was ridiculous of me to say what I said. And what I said was, I miss the suits. I miss the guys that would tell the young bands, get out of here. You're not ready. Because what we have is this flood of garbage. And I'm sorry if that hurts the feelings of these working musicians, but there was a reason for this. And now I think it takes away from quantity is not quality. You know, I would much rather have five things to listen to, and out of those five, go back to three, and out of those three, find one that's amazing, than have 100 records in front of me that I could just listen to 30 seconds at a time and find one song.
But isn't that like what music lovers are kind of turning to curators such as yourself, who love music and were telling us, hey, go listen to Ricky Lee Jones' new album?
Yes, of course. The idea is the same, okay? But I feel like more and more, all these older people, these legends and near legends who have been making music forever.
Boz Scaggs, Paul McCartney, and so on.
Whoever they are. Yeah, they're tossed aside. Oh, it's another Boz Scaggs record. Oh, it's another Paul McCartney record. Or it's another John Hyatt record. Richard Thompson, another one.
Well, because everybody's trying to find the next big thing. And, you know, if you can be the person that found the next big thing, you must be a curator of note.
My goal, personally, I don't look to find the next big thing. There was a time when I was fully embracing all new music. Anytime there was a great power pop label called Not Lame Records, run by a wonderful, wonderful guy named Bruce Brodeen. And he just put out so much power pop from bands from all over the world. And I would buy and listen to everyone because I loved what he was doing. Until I realized that they were mostly just good. They weren't amazing. They were mostly just all in the same vein. Beatlesque. Every band was reviewed the same way. If you like the Beatles, Big Star, Queen, Jellyfish, there was 25 bands to describe what each band sounded like. And it became boring for me because they were all fine. None of them were amazing. So more and more, with the access to so much music, more and more I started to lose faith because I would listen and these great things would never be great. And so I'm starting to embrace it less because I've been disappointed so often.
Well, I mean, when you've got access to all the music in history, and that's practically speaking what we have right now. I mean, I know things slip through the cracks, but, you know, whatever you name, you can get access to pretty easily. That's kind of amazing. But that means, hey, guess what? If you've got a new album and you want me to pay attention to your album rather than listening again to Louis Armstrong's Hot Fives or the Beach Boys or all the great classic music that deserves repeated listening, you better be darn good, right? There's a much higher bar. When you haven't heard anything and you don't know about Nick Drake, any new album might be exciting. But if you hear the great albums, then you're less willing to accept okay or new stuff that sort of just rehashes what's been done before, right?
Well, yes. And one of the phrases I use on the blog frequently is the bar has not been lowered, it's been buried. And that's sort of what I feel. You know, just to a good example, I don't think I've ever met anyone who loves and respects Rick Astley. Okay? Rick Astley became a punchline after Never Gonna Give You Up. All right, sure, it sold billions, but the video with the big bulky sweater and the little head, he was a punchline for any of the people that you know, wrote about whatever you want to call it. He wasn't a respected artist, period. There's no other way to say it. I'm being flat out. Rick Astley, no matter how big that single was a punchline, okay? Now we have Sam Smith, who's basically Rick Astley.
And that's without a catchy single.
Yeah, well, he's Rick Astley with a James Bond theme song to his name.
And a song that ripped off Tom Petty. But now he's carrying a whole bunch of Grammys and everybody thinks he's this soul sensation. And he's not. You know, I mean, not to my ears. To me, he's just Rick Astley. It's the same thing with God Forgive Me. Okay, I know this is a sacrilege, but Adele. Adele is this absolutely fine young singer, songwriter with a terrific voice who has a couple of really great singles. And people, and I don't blame Adele for this, I blame the media, people are calling her this generation's Beatles or Barbara Streisand.
Well,
I mean,
she's got
three records out.
And two of them are the best sellings of all time.
Yeah, well, and she's got a broad audience. For, you know, my 9-year-old loves her, and you know, I've heard 72-year-old to 80-year-olds are loving her, and they say that how much they love her. So when you have pleased an audience that is that wide and that, you know, broad, it's easy to see why she's kind of taken off,
overhyped.
Yeah,
right. But is she that good, or is it just because everything else is not that good?
Well, she's not that good yet, but I would like to see her in concert. Now, am I an old fart for even caring what Rolling Stone names as the best albums of the year?
Yeah, I don't even read. I don't even look because it's irrelevant to me what they say.
Well, they have a top 20 list, and I think in the top 10, you have one album. In the top 20, I think you have one album in common, which is the Boz Skaggs.
Boz Skaggs, right. Yeah.
Right. So
well,
Rolling
Stones. I know Keith Richards made their list.
Yes, he did.
And I know diehard Rolling Stones fans who think that album is absolute crap. So, yeah. So I mean, that's the problem with Rolling Stone. It's very, very obvious who's going to get on there. Is U2 on there by any chance?
No, they did not make the top 20 at least. I mean, they have 50, so a lot of people do that shouldn't, but their top 20 is what I focused on. Number one is Kendrick Lamar with To Pimp a Butterfly, which will hopefully win the Grammy for Best Album of the Year and probably win the Village Voice Paz Jop poll.
Well, you know what? I'm going to stop you there because I tried to listen to that album again and I was in, polite company, shall we say. This is not an album you can listen to. It's not. It's a not safe for work album. Let's put it
that
way.
Well, nobody said it was. Why would you assume you could?
All right.
And number two is Adele, 25, which you can play for your grandmother and your grandchild. And that got a 5-star Stone Cold Classic review from Rolling Stone. And number three is Drake. If you're reading this, it's too late. And number four is D'Angelo, Black Messiah. And number five is The Weeknd. And number six is Courtney Barnett. And number seven is Jason Isbell. And number eight is the cast album for Hamilton. And number nine is the offshoot Black Keys project, The Arcs. And at number 10 is Blur with The Magic Whip.
With the exception of and I'll admit to not loving the Kendrick Lamar record, but not because I don't see the
intelligence or goodness. Yeah.
It's not what I embrace. And so, but I understand it. I understand that being on everyone's everyone's number one. I get it.
Well, so what you're saying is it's a well crafted and good piece of art. However, it's just not the kind of art you like.
Absolutely. That's perfectly said. Exactly. Adele. I mean, why? I mean, I haven't seen Hamilton and I'm not even criticizing Hamilton, but it shouldn't be on. That has to be a separate category.
It's a hip hop album. It's an R&B hip hop album. Why does it have to be in a separate category? Unless you think Jason Isbell doesn't belong on there either.
It's scored from a Broadway musical.
But it's hip hop. But Jason Isbell shouldn't be on there because he's not rock.
I see it as two different things. I see it's to me, it's almost the same as putting, you know, the best albums of the year and choosing, you know, The Big Short. It's a separate thing to me to be on Broadway and write music for Broadway musical. I think you put that there and you don't put, you know, however many other people didn't make the top 10 who created a record. Who created a pop record or a rock record or a heavy metal record or a hip hop record?
Or this apparently is, jazz, because you do have jazz in your top 10.
Well, I have one jazz record in my top 10. I have one. But I also understand, you know, the top 10 jazz records versus the, you know, it's still not something that was created for a different medium.
Okay. Well, I could see a film score being on my list too. But you've got your 10 best albums of the year. Do you have your list there, or should I read it for you? Or and how hard was it for you to come up with?
I don't have
it
in front of me, but I think I could remember it. But if there's something specific, you know.
Okay. Well, this is interesting because there are some names here that I'm sure our listeners will be hearing for the first time. And I'm not talking about, I'm going to just mention some of the names here that they may have heard of. Jeff Lynne's ELO, Alone in the Universe.
Well, let's just do the top 10.
Okay.
Let's list it. At number one, number 10, and let's go exciting, is Kamasi Washington
with the epic. They're not in order. They are just randomly up there.
Okay. So I'll do it randomly then. Your 10 best albums of the year are John Cleary with Go Go Juice, Jeff Lynne's ELO with Alone in the Universe, Franz Ferdinand Sparks, which is a collaboration between the band Franz Ferdinand and the Sparks, Joe Jackson with his new album Fast Forward, Ricky Lee Jones with her perhaps New Orleans album to a degree with The Other Side of Desire, The London Souls with their second album, Here Come the Girls, Orange Humble Band, who I absolutely never heard of, with Depressing Beauty, Boz Scaggs with A Fool to Care, Squeeze with Cradle to the Grave, and a jazz album, The Epic by Kamasi Washington.
So
that's the list.
Well, can you explain John Cleary? Okay, here's somebody who I kind of know but don't know. Why is Go Go Juice on the list here? Not that I'm countering it. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that album.
I love John Cleary as a piano player. I love the people he has on the record. And I love the fact that John Cleary does not get caught up in creating or pandering to the New Orleans fans out there. There are so many New Orleans artists with such talent, but they feel the need to have a song about gumbo, have a song about second lining, have a song about jambalaya, and it becomes very novelty. And this record, and almost all of John Cleary's records, they're not novelty. They're real old-fashioned New Orleans funk and R&B, the way Alan Toussaint would make a record, or the way the Meters would make a record, or Irma Thomas would make a record. It's very organic, and it's it's in my wheelhouse.
So what you're saying is, if you're making a New Orleans album and your name is Buckwheat Zydeco, okay, fine, put a song about gumbo on it, because you pretty much invented it, or at least popularized it. But if you're John Cleary, hey, do your own thing.
Well, I'm not sure if that's what I'm saying, but yes. What I'm saying is you could get Kermit Ruffins, who has become the ambassador of, you know, New Orleans music. He's this Louis Armstrong type, playing, you know, anything from, you know, old trad jazz to his own little brand of funk. And he's fine. Everybody loves him. And if he's playing, I suggest going to see him play. But every one of his records has a, you know, New Orleans is my hometown. Everybody, you know, get in line. It becomes less of a piece of art and more like a snow globe. You know, it's just like, oh, here's a good snapshot of New Orleans. We'll have the Zydeco tune. We'll have another cover of When the Saints Go Marching In. It's all fine. But Cleary writes original songs and arranges the songs. And it's just refreshing. It's a refreshing, you know, sound coming out of the city.
Was it hard for you to get to 10 albums, or was it hard to pare down to 10 albums, or what kind of year of music was it for you?
I think the joke I made on my blog was, I don't even like my 10 favorite albums of the year. that's how difficult it was to come up with records. And I listened to so many, and there were so many I really wanted to like. I really wanted to like the Arcs, the Black Keys, Richard Swift project. I really did. And I found by the fifth song I was listening to the same thing. It was mostly style over substance. It was mostly the affected vocals and the textures in the production, but there was nothing to sink my teeth into. And that's what I feel about so much music.
Well, now, what about Courtney Barnett? Because a lot could be said there that, you know, it's the same thing over and over again. I don't know if you're familiar with...
That's why she's not on his list.
I loved the opening track, which I guess was the single. I heard that and I was hooked, and it just didn't sustain that for me. I see the appeal again. I think I would definitely listen to her next record. I didn't dislike the record. I just don't think it's all that. I think it's one amazing song, a couple of okay songs, and songs you know, you couldn't hum if your life depended on it.
Well, she doesn't hum them either. She speaks them, and the song you're thinking of is Pedestrian at best.
Yes, we'll go with that.
So you had a non-music day job for a little while, which really depressed me. But I'm so excited now that you're recording, you got your band, your record shows are working a little better for you. I don't know whether, have you ever despaired that music would not be able to be the center of whatever you do in your life, or is there just no way that's not going to happen?
I just don't know what else I would do. That's the thing. I mean, it's, what am I going to just give up the records and, you know, I'll be a surgeon. You know, I mean, I'll work. I'll be a haberdasher. You know, it's this is what I live and breathe it. I wake up and it's coffee and music. And at night when I'm watching baseball, it's with the sound off and there's music on. And it's what I enjoy. I love talking about it. I love playing it for people. And I'm still incredibly moved by it. I mean, to the point where, you know, I was watching a rerun of Live from Daryl's House last night on cable.
That's the Daryl Hall of Hall & Oates music show.
And it was the Christmas episode with Shelby Lynn. And twice I was just about to burst into tears, not necessarily because of something sad. It was just phenomenal musically. And I get so worked up from it that I can't see not doing something with it.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time to come on the show and talk about your music. We'll have links to Burning Wood, your website, and we'll have a list of your favorite albums of the year. People will check them out, and we look forward to talking to you again soon when your album comes out with your new band.
That's great. I'd love to talk about that when it comes out, so thank you.
Thank you, and thanks for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thanks again.
Well, that was good of him to stop by. I haven't finished my best albums of the year yet. I usually do it timed to the Grammys because I've got a lot of catching up to do because music is not my
bailiwick.
But I do listen to a lot while I'm traveling down south and back up again. So that's a good chance. But I do have a rough draft of some of the albums I've been listening to a lot and loving. You can find that in the show notes as well, along with Sal's stuff.
Well, should we go over your... But yeah, Boss Gags made your list. So one of these is going to be on your... Hey, Courtney Barnett.
Kendrick
Lamar?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And at the top of my list is Sufjan Stevens with Carrie and Lowell. I know that will probably be my number one album of the year. I can't believe more people don't have it on their list and higher up.
Yeah, I think maybe it was too depressing for people.
I don't know. It's beautifully sad. Yes. Nick Drake.
Well, speaking of musicians and music that we liked, Scott Weiland here. You have a story about...
We said it didn't look like it was drug-related, but his wife had a rather moving op-ed that she wrote on Rolling Stone saying, well, you know what? Drugs were at the heart of it, even if it wasn't directly related to how he died. She talked about how he was just not part of the lives of her children and how she tried to protect them. And if you want to honor his memory, don't buy a damn t-shirt. Take a kid you know out to a ball game or for ice cream, pay them attention the way Scott wasn't quite able to for his kids. She clearly had a lot of affection for him. She wasn't running him down, but she did talk about the toll that drug abuse had had on him for many, many years. And it's pretty moving and touching. And she clearly, you know, has love and respect for him, even though he was out of their lives mostly towards the end. But there's a link in our show notes to read that. I just wanted to clarify when we were talking about how he died.
Well, and, you know, a couple points here. One, he has, Scott Weiland always talked about how drugs pretty much ruined the marriage to his ex-wife. And so
You but know, he hadn't gotten his act together, which was hopefully what one was thinking while he was out on the road and all that.
Well, we don't know for sure.
Well, his wife says he didn't, that he was a mess.
No, it's his ex-wife.
Yeah, his ex-wife said he was a mess up until the end.
Oh, okay. Well,
that's the whole point of the op-ed.
Okay. Well, my other point was going to be, even if drugs weren't necessarily, as you say, at the heart of it, you know, they take a toll on your body. They, as you know, and they...
Yeah, we're not talking about the physical cause of his death. We're just saying that it messed up his life and his relationship with his children and all that, and it was too sad, and there you go.
Well, but somebody's still alive, actually, is Kirk Douglas.
Yes, he is. He just turned 99. He was born on December 9th of 1916. Why wait until someone dies to celebrate their career? The BFI had a list, a tribute to Kirk Douglas. I thought, yeah, why always got to do obits? Hey, Kirk Douglas, still alive. Joni Mitchell, still alive. They had a list of his 10 best movies. I would highlight three of them. Spartacus, of course, the rare, intelligent sword and sandal epic. Ace in the Hole, Billy Wilder's blistering takedown of journalism, and Out of the Past, which may be the greatest noir of all time. Those are just three great movies, so all well worth checking out. And you know what? I'm so happy for Kirk. I want to sing him happy birthday to you. Now, you may want to stop me because you don't want to have to pay for the rights to happy birthday, but in fact, we had talked before about a lawsuit of involving Happy Birthday and whether it should be in the public domain. They've come to an agreement and a settlement, and the song will soon officially be in the public domain so we can all sing it as much as we want without having to pay a fee.
Well, and I can't believe that Paths to Glory, the Stanley Kubrick film starring Kirk Douglas, is not in your list.
I can't accept him as a Frenchman. I find it absurd. Watched that movie, and it's just so ridiculous to me that he's playing a Frenchman. He's the least French person ever alive, and it just I can't deal with it. It just doesn't work for me. I don't mind a British person playing a Nazi. You know, the Nazis have British accents and a lot of Hollywood, fine. But Kirk Douglas as a Frenchman, it just doesn't work.
You mean Christopher Plummer playing an Austrian is fine.
Well, he wasn't a Nazi. He was anti-Nazi.
Well, I know. I was walking down that road, and I was like, oh, I shouldn't have ever
started. He's playing an Austrian, right, with totally not an Austrian accent. I understand that. But somehow, Kirk Douglas, wandering through those trenches as a Frenchman, I just could never get beyond that block.
Well, hopefully, you could buy both Michael and myself as your tour guides through the world of entertainment for the past week during our show this week. And we do appreciate that you listen. And we love it when you subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. Michael mentioned our show notes several times during the episode. And indeed, links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us and also the links to Sal Nunziato's work. And I'd like to thank Sal once again for joining us. You can also find ways to follow us on Twitter at ShowbizSandbox is our handle. You can find ways to email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Ways to call us, 888-567-7263. You can also like us on Facebook. Search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up. And again, all of that information on showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz, you have a website every week. It's something new and exciting. What is it this week?
Oh my God, I forgot. It's, I have to get work on my best 10 albums of the year list.com.
Yeah, there's no way, by the way. I cannot type all of that into a.com. I'm sorry. You're going to have to shorten that domain. Could you do just an acronym, maybe?
10best.com. I bet it's taken.
Okay. I'm sure you're right, actually. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, you can try, thehuffingtonpost.com, where you can find some of his writing. And all of his work winds up on michaelgiltz.com. And, of course, you can always check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week. Play nice.
All right, join us at the after show. Sperling and I keep arguing all day long.